account the dignity of other people and the fact that there are other people who have certain rights.
Peace in the Middle East basically will come when the clergy in the mosque on Friday preach it, and when the rabbis in the synagogue on Saturday preach it. During the time of Camp David, one, you had political leadership that was able to contain that type of religious fervor. What the country needs is some prescient understanding of what is going to happen in the future. Welcome to another Leon Chani Report. We're talking to you from Tel Aviv, Israel, at the Great Hilton Hotel, by the way, which is sold out. You can't get a room here, which means tourism is up, and the Maccabiah, which is the Israeli Olympics, is here. And we're having a lot of fun talking with Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel, who's now, running again to become the chairman of the Labor Party, but who's known as a wise man and a brilliant strategic thinker. Welcome, Ehud.
Thank you. My mother would love to hear you.
Even your father.
Yeah.
Ehud, first of all, today is a very important day in Israeli's history. I think there's a big march today on against the disengagement. How's that going to work?
I hope it will work well for the future of all of us, and we'll overcome this painful event. You know, the settlers are really brothers of us. We have to live together afterwards, and they invested most of their lives over there, sent by Israeli governments of both sides of the political aisle. And but now they face a painful decision taken by a freely elected government. We should do that. The state cannot give up its authority over its citizens, and what had been decided should be implemented. I hope.
Isn't this the classical argument in Jewish history between the clergy and the government? Now, I was at a special ceremony with the chief of staff and Mofaz, where they honored people, especially from units like yours. I don't know why I was there, but as an American, I got in for some reason. They liked me. And what I saw there is Mofaz made a terrific speech about the primary, as you say, the primary responsibility of citizens are to obey the government. But what do you say to two chief rabbis who tell boys who are in the army, and you're a chief of staff of the army, what do you say to those rabbis and to those guys?
I think the rabbis are wrong. You know, in the past, rabbis in Israel used to deal with whatever between the individual and heaven, and between the individual and its friend. They never entered into politics.
Right.
And we have a saying in Hebrew, Dina de Malchuta Dina, namely the law of the state, of any kind of authority, the king or whatever. It's a law. You're not questioning it.
Right.
I think that they are wrong. But they are acting out of what they believe they should do. And some of their followers are in the army, in uniform. And in uniform, you can reject only an order which is obviously illegal. You cannot disobey just something.
You can't get your conscience involved in whether you're following an order or not.
You have in it. If someone would tell you, shoot this 12-year-old girl, you should say, I'm not going to do it, whatever order from whoever I get it. But when it comes to the decisions of a freely elected government in regard to the political issues, even however painful, we should be able to leave it. Basically, my argument with those settlers is about the rules of the game of democracy. We cannot expect them to agree with us. They invested too much in those places. And I hope it will be better than most of us are afraid or feel. And probably it will be less kind of comfortable or smooth than most of us would have hoped.
We interviewed a few generals, Knesset fellows, Vilnai, Dani Atom. Everybody thought it would work fairly well. I remember the old Camp David days.
I hope.
Before your Camp David 2, when we were involved with Yamit, and it seemed to have been, it did a little bit better than people thought.
Yeah.
The last time you were on the show, you were very pronounced in your feelings about Arafat. You said you went to Camp David, you gave him a proposal, and he never came back with a counter-proposal. That was your quote, and a very important quote. Now we have Abbas, and I'm sure you know Abbas, correct?
Yeah.
Is there much difference between the two of these guys?
There is much difference in style. Abbas is more kind of...
He's cultured more.
No, but yeah, he doesn't have this kafia or the uniform and the visions of Palestinian children on the walls of Jerusalem. He talks reasonably. He talks very courageously to the Arab side and the Palestinians about the damage inflicting upon them by their terror. But he doesn't act accordingly. He's very hesitant on action. And basically, he's in a way, he's more sophisticated rival because he's acceptable to the world. He is listened to. He can draw support from the world, and no one knows how his real intentions. I cannot know whether in a moment of truth he will behave differently. No one can know it. In fact, in Camp David, at a crucial moment, he invented some family wedding in Jordan and left.
Is that right?
Yeah, just not to be there. Probably it's a good sign. I don't know. probably he didn't want to be there when Arafat destroyed it all. But probably he just was not there in his mind, readiness to
they didn't want
to
be
to
there.
Follow.
There was a
lesson beyond the need for leadership, need for extreme sobriety, open-eyed kind of approach to reality on both sides, because both leaders appear to make concessions in a peace that are not acceptable, at least to their power base, sometimes to the majority of their people at the beginning. It is only the leadership that shape later on the perception of reality of the majority or dominant silent majority in their own peoples to support it. And there is a need for this kind of vision, because if you focus on the immediate threats, immediate risk, and of on uncertainties, which are always abundant, you might reach a kind of conclusion which seems to be inevitable and deterministic, that peace will lead to nowhere. But that's not true in the case of the Middle East. We have to find a way to do it with the rest of our neighbors.
And there were many mistakes along the way with Oslo, technical and security-wise, in some of the tactics that were influenced by Shimon and others, how to deal with the tricks and manipulation of Arafat. But the overall course of action was fully justifiable, even in retrospect. I believe that Oslo, as well as Camp David, ultimately are part of the solution, not part of the problem. The original problem, the original sin, if you will, is the lunatic vision of planting a Jewish settlement in between any two Arab Palestinian cities, towns, or villages. The decision of Ben-Gurion to accept the partition plan was a precondition for the creation of a Zionist, democratic
UN
Jewish
state.
And he was open-eyed. He knew that he will get in exchange for his readiness to take the partition plan. He was open-eyed. He knew that he might get a full-scale war. But the very fact that he was ready was a clarity of mind and strategic judgment.
I think that a line could be delineated within the land of Israel, within which we'll have a solid Jewish majority for generations to come, which is extremely important for us, for our identity, for our future. It can include 80% or 90% of the, or 85% of the settlers, and of course include all the Jewish suburbs in Jerusalem. That together make it some... In Jerusalem alone, it's more than 200,000 people, Israelis, and in the settlement blocks and the settlements along the old border, it's about probably 290 out of 350. It's about everyone, except for the last 60,000 settlers, which will probably be living in some 50 or 60 isolated settlements. Those settlements should have three options. Either to come on personal basis, get some lump of compensation that will enable each family to buy a home, either in the settlement blocks, which will remain ours, or in the Israel proper. A second, for those who want to live or keep living as a community, there are very successful communities there that are already bringing up their grandchildren. They're committed Israeli, very, very good, very involved and important. If they want to move as a settlement, they can get a pause of 3 years within which we can build a settlement in one of the settlement blocks or other preferred area of their choice. I believe that there probably might be several thousand, very relatively small numbers of people who say we are not ready to leave, we do not accept it, and we want to stay. And probably the right way is to let them to stay. We will have to find an arrangement to secure them, but let them stay under small islets under within or surrounded by Palestinian sovereignty, with some kind of Israeli law should still be applicable to them. I don't think that it's important. I don't delude myself that it's simple, but I don't think that once an agreement for generations might be considered, that will be an impossible obstacle to or insurmountable obstacle to cross.
I'll tell you something you might not know. You know, I was very close with Weizmann. Yeah. And awesome. Weizmann left the government when Menachem Begin, allegedly over a budget fight for defense, yeah. He told Begin that there was an opportunity at that time to make a deal for the Palestinians. Sadat wanted a post office and a flag in Jerusalem. Yeah. And Begin was no. Then we had a convention of the old Camp David guys with President Carter in Washington. Yeah. And Sam Lewis, the former ambassador, had said to me, Leon, did Begin have buyer's remorse about the Camp David agreement? And I would have to say he did. Yes, I think he did. Because, you know, the whole thing with 5 years and not 5 years. So yeah. These are historical things. In 67, when you captured everything, the only guy that I've interviewed over the course of years who said that they thought about the future was Abba Ibn. Do you read the history books of 60? You were a young guy then. But
no, I was already a captain.
You were a captain, but did anybody think about the fact that you couldn't control 10 million Arabs at that time?
At the time, it was not clear, but the first reactions of the government were very cautious. Namely, they realized that there is a great opportunity there, but they hesitated what to do, and they basically kept it as a kind of chip for future negotiations. It was only after the Arab side said the three no's of Khartoum, namely no agreement, no negotiation, no everything that was taken by force will be brought back by force, and such kind of militant declaration that we began carefully to establish these security-related settlement blocks and the satellite cities around Jerusalem. And it took, you know, until 77, that was the case. So basically, you know, we have our own share of mistakes along the way. Labor, including Yitzhak, Yigal Alon and Shimon Peres. But basically, the true story is that Likud moved us there. And we entered into this adventure that had never any chances of becoming reality. The main, I don't know, the Camino Real of Zionism was a disengagement between us and the Arabs and concentrating on an area where we will have a solid Jewish majority for generations to come. And we thought all along the way since 67 that at a certain point we'll have to disengage from all the Palestinians and most of the areas in exchange for normalization. And now we reach a point where we cannot do it through an agreement, and I proposed in 2001, immediately after Camp David, that since we cannot find a partner in Mr. Arafat, it shouldn't paralyze us as a nation. We should turn into the only viable alternative, which is to take our destiny in our own hands. Set a defensive security fence on the lines of the Camp David proposal, and dismantle gradually all the Israeli settlement, bringing them back home, hit on terror, and leave the door open for resumption of negotiations at any moment, based on the same principles of Camp David, the same point that was on the table.
Your Camp David.
Yeah. Same issues that were on the table a day before the Palestinians turned to terror. So to, on one hand, not to reward them for their turning to terror, on another hand, not to punish them collectively as a people for the short-sightedness of their leader at the time.
I think that unlike the situation in Europe, the end of World War II, where, you know, these nations, they slaughtered each other twice in the first half of the 20th century on a massive scale. But the moment World War II ended, immediately it was ripe for peace. You could found Adenauer on one side and the French leader on the other side. Within several years, they became very friendly because they grew up from the same culture with all differences, same religions, at least arching religions, same background, same history of Europe, those, something common. So over there, people, a kind of peace, when the situation was ripe, came very naturally to the peoples. Here it's not the same. It's much more kind of omni kind of conflict. It's different. It's about territory. It's about religion, ethical resources, interpretation of history. It's everything. Won't be easy. I think that in this regard, Camp David 1 gives a good example. It is something that should be imposed at first by a contractual framework created by leaders. And at first it will be accepted, not under protest, but with a great uneasiness by the public. It is only later on, if we can keep together the contractual framework that was created by the leaders with support of the rest of the world. Only then a process will start. It probably will take a generation, two or three, before education and the processes on normalization will lower the hostilities. And even this is not sure. You cannot assure it. So I don't underestimate the worries and fears of those on the right wing in Israel that say, oh, it's all in vain. They are hating us. Nothing will happen. Look at the whole history.
But Ehud, under your Camp David, you had a Jerusalem plan to divide Jerusalem. Do you think that could have passed in a Knesset here?
Of course. Not easily, but I'm confident that if there was on the other side a leader of the caliber of President Sadat of Egypt or King Hussein of Jordan, and as a deal had been struck, it would have a dramatic shaping impact on the frame of mind of Israelis, and we would have an uphill battle, but that one that would have been won, knocking on any door, convincing the people. You know, I tell my right-wing friends, I have more friends among the Likud Central Committee than in my own party. And I have many friends, but we have disputes. So I'm telling them, you know, according to my plan, Jerusalem would have become larger, stronger, and more Jewish than ever in history. We would adapt immediately, annex Givat Zev, Male Dumim, and Gush Etzion, and in exchange, giving the Arabs most of the heavily populated neighborhoods. Most of them had never been Jerusalem. We just annexed them after 67. And
keep on our side all the Jewish neighborhoods and the old city and the Mount of Olives, the Holy Basin, we call it. So it would still live within Israel some 35 or 40,000 Arabs. But the other 240 or 250,000 would become part of the Palestinian entity. It will relieve us of huge burden, financial and otherwise, and make it more normal. And I used to tell them, you know, we prayed for 2,000 years, next year in Jerusalem. We never prayed next year in Shuafat, or next year in Abu Dis, or Isawiyah, never. Doesn't mean anything. And even some of those neighborhoods of Jerusalem that were annexed post-67 or were part of the Jordanian Jerusalem, I used to talk to those Ne'emanei Yerushalayim, the devotees of Jerusalem. I used to tell them, if I give you now the key of my Cadillac and ask you to take me to the neighborhood called Wadi Kadum in Jerusalem, you don't know even where to drive. You are the best supporter of, greatest supporters of Jerusalem. You had never been there. No person that you know had ever been there. You don't even know where is it. Where to drive? I tell you, go to Wadi Kadum. It's part of the sacred Jerusalem, the united forever. You don't know where is it. So there is a limit to the theater of absurd we should impose upon ourselves. You know, I used to talk to President Clinton about the situation that we are facing when we are dealing with Jerusalem. I told him, you know, think of a neighboring entity to whom you had already given Chevy Chase and Silver Spring, and now they begin to
cry.
No, or you gave them Bethesda and Rockville, now they're shooting into Chevy Chase and Silver Spring, and they demand presence in the mall. So it's ridiculous. It's something impossible, almost impossible. And it could be solved only if open-eyed, courageous leaders on both sides will be ready to take painful decisions facing their own constituencies, not just each other. And I was ready for the test, and I was convinced that we should find out whether we have a partner or not. In business terms, the whole Oslo process was a future contract where we are supposed to
hey, we know each other a long time, yeah. And you're a fun guy and all, but the rap on you is that you're a soloist, that you work alone, that you did everything on your own. This was one of the raps against you, that you didn't consult enough people. Do you take that as a
I should find a better rapper to tell the true story. It's never been true, but it's an urban legend that took hold, like many other urban legends. I'm working on correcting the impression, not the reality. The reality had never been there. But to correct this kind of image.
It's not the first time you heard it.
No, it's not the first time. It's not true. I work with so many people. You know, I accomplished several things along my life. None of them could have been accomplished without.
Why do you think this came about then? Is that just from the other side?
Yeah, it's a part of that. Usually it's from your side. Never from, the other side could be critical, but it's never effective. But when criticism coming from your own side, and they're always... you know, I don't want even to spread I'm responsible for whatever happened during my being at the helm of Israel. And that's, bearing in mind the consequences of what we have done, I can understand people looking for something to...
Excuses,
something to blame. But basically, you know, it's a...
Well, there are things that happen. President Carter, whom I work for, is thought to be an anti-Semite. Yeah. He's an anti-Semite like you're a Moroccan dancer. He has done more for Jews. And a quote from Menachem Begin in his tones during Camp David, never has there been such a good president, President Carter. But the rap is on him that he's anti-Semitic because he talks to Palestinians, and I defend him. So everybody gets these types of raps. But
Americans, I hope that they have the same kind of conviction, the courage of conviction that Carter brought with him, so was on the bordering on messianic kind of mission. He was so kind of religiously almost convinced that he has to do it, and that's the time. And, you know, when you judge it in retrospect, it has huge impact and great influence. When I was more than 20 years later at Camp David negotiating with Clinton, with Arafat, trying to continue into Palestine, there is a hut in Camp David where you can see on the walls memorabilia of the first Camp David of Carter. And I noticed there on the walls pieces of paper with his personal handwriting, writing comments after meeting with Osama Elbaz, the legal advisor to the Egyptians, and Aaron Barak, our legal advisor, after meeting with Dayan or Weizmann, after meeting with Sadat or Begin. And he invested so intensively his own political capital, his own personal influence, his own conviction in it, that it was something unique and unprecedented before and in a way since. And basically, you know, I'm aware of the fact that the first Israeli leader to go into the kind of experience that I had been through, namely to be ready to accept a daring, painful plan for solution, just to be responded by a bloody war, was Ben-Gurion. And we know in retrospect how far-sighted he were while deciding about his readiness to establish two states. And it's, you know, no one sought to blame Ben-Gurion in the eruption of the War of Independence. It was clear to us that the pyromane is responsible for the fire, namely the Palestinian side was responsible for it, or the Arab side. And we should somehow have this kind of
distance
and kind of distance and capacity to look at it in perspective that will bring people to realize that we have done the right thing in proposing it. The Palestinians are responsible for what followed, and that at certain point we will have all of us to adapt the same plan that I put on the table in 2001, namely to complete the security fence, to dismantle, bring back home the isolated settlements, however painful, and to build a de facto border within which we'll have a solid Jewish majority for generations to come, where you know why you are killing whoever tries to attack you and is ready to be killed, but you protect basically your home. And I really believe in the line of Robert Frost in Mending a Fence. He said, good fences make good neighbors. It's only the starting point, but a prerequisite for any future, that we will sit behind these security borders, open the door for resumption of negotiation when there is a Palestinian leader who is ready to make decisions.
What did it take for Ben-Gurion to fire on Eyal Talena? What kind of courage was that?
It was his first of all, it was after.
This was the firing against the Jewish ship by Ben-Gurion. He ordered, by the way, Yitzhak Rabin was the guy who fired.
He ordered it against the Menachem Begin, basically, a ship full of weapons.
Right.
That the Irgun, the Etzel, the Begin Irgun, thought should be delivered or conveyed to his, so to speak, fighters in Jerusalem. Remember that the partition plan that Ben-Gurion accepted did not include Jerusalem as part of Israel. So in Israel, it was clear that there is only one army, but in Jerusalem, which was at the time out of Israel, so to speak, there were different fighters. There were the State of Israel fighter and the Menachem Begin fighter.
So
he wanted to provide them with munitions and weapons. And Ben-Gurion said, no, there will be only one authority.
Right.
The very basic attribute of a sovereign, a legitimate sovereign, is the monopoly on the use of weapons. And he insisted on it, and he was ready to go to the situation where Jews will kill Jews in order to impose the authority of the newly born state on however important. Begin was the head of an important
organization that contributed a lot to the creation of the state. He was ready to go that far. But when we compare this to the demands we have from the Palestinians, for example, from Abu Mazen, we should not ignore the fact that Ben-Gurion took it only after there was a Jewish state recognized by the whole world. And and of course, we were happy to see Abu Mazen doing it before there is a Palestinian state, because for us it's better, but we can hardly expect it to happen as long as they are not attacking Abu Mazen himself and the Fatah organization.
All right, this is great stuff. We're going to hold for a break.
Every budget, so don't accept defeat. Now you can get covered in steel.
Buy me treats.
You take care of your pets. Now it's their turn to take care of you. Visit GetCoveredAmerica.org to learn about your health insurance options.
Thanks for calling the GED Pep Talk Center. Jerry Stiller speaking. Your level 7 in your face pep talk.
I can keep pushing. Believe me, I'm good at it. But at some point, you're going to need to start pushing yourself.
See, once you've got your GED diploma, you'll feel so good about yourself.
You tough. Can't change your past, but you can definitely change your future.
That makes me so happy, I'm ready to bust out a dance.
Mr. Trejo, can I transfer this guy to you? My gentle technique isn't really working. You need something a little more...
persuasive?
Yes.
You listen, and you listen good.
Hey, where's my sandwich?
Terry?
Terry!
Take it from me to King DMC. It's a real cool thing to get your GED.
Get that diploma!
Now hold on and we'll find you free GED classes. Capiche?
Whatever motivation you need, we've got a pep talk for you. Get your GED pep talk and find free classes at yourged.org.
I wish I was in school.
If only I had a math test today.
I'll stay after class.
I'll clean the chalkboard.
I wish I was in school.
School ends, but free lunches for your kids don't have to. Find your local food bank at feedingamerica.org/summermeals for help.
It's one of the many ways to fight osteoarthritis pain. For more information on managing pain, go to fightarthritispain.org.
When you throw away money on wasted electricity, you're throwing away everything you could have bought with it. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Kitchen surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water. 1 in 6 Americans will get sick from food poisoning this year. Keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov.
Hey, going out like that?
Yeah, why?
Well, what would the neighbors think?
I see you!
Come look at Mr. Feather!
Look what I have.
Mr. Bird, remember?
We're just playing. I'm trying to get you out of here.
Even still.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
We're back. I'm talking with Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, the most decorated soldier in Israeli Defense Force history. and really relaxed. He's sort of having a good time and expressing himself for the betterment. You really are relaxed now. You're really in good shape. I mean, I've seen you.
I'm watching you. I see you relaxed. Why shouldn't I be relaxed?
It's great. Boogie Yalom, your former chief of staff, and that's a tough job to be, as you know, had a three-year term. They didn't put him in for the fourth term. He gave a huge report or journal interview in Haaretz, a newspaper here, and it was a little doomful. The next week, Avi Dichter, who was head of Shin Bet, sort of was very optimistic. Where do you put these two guys?
I think I highly appreciate both of them. I nominated Dichter for his term as a prime minister and nominated Boogie Yalom in previous terms or positions of him. Two of them are some of the best people ever devoted their lives for the security of Israel. The difference between them is not that big as it looks. Basically, both are pragmatic, security-oriented players, or defense-oriented. They together ran these last 4 years of fighting against terror. You could find a certain quiet, open-eyed and gloomy predictions in what Dichter had said in the weeks before, and between the lines you can find it even in this interview. But he emphasized more the fact that nothing is going to defeat us, which is self-evident for Boogie as well. For probably Boogie, out of being so self-confident about the future of Israel, allowed himself to go more into the details of what's waiting us down the stream in order to help prepare the population for what's going to follow post-disengagement from Gaza. So basically...
But did Boogie eliminate the possibility of a two-state solution in his interview? Was that what he was saying?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. He clearly says that that's what's good for Israel. But if we do not take actions, if we leave it into the default mode, no one can predict what happens. If we are not taking initiative to correct things, to take our destiny in hands, to do what should be done, it could deteriorate into a one-state situation. And I don't think that Dichter is very optimistic about what will happen if we don't do anything. But he says we can do and we will do, and somehow Boogie Yalom was the head of the intelligence community in the past, where you have to give attention to the wider picture, longer, much deeper into history and in a much wider context. And Dichter used to deal with eliminating bad guys and protecting the good guys and making sure that an operation will be concluded positively. So he had much more somewhat tactical or technical approach to things. That might be the explanation for the difference. Basically, there are two great fighters, two great patriots of Israel. I think that any successful agreement we had with the Arabs started far from the public eye. It was true about Camp David first, both with Tuhami and the Haka, and then Tuhami and Dayan. It was the case clearly with the Palestinians for whatever we had achieved. Oslo started far from the public eye, the woods of Scandinavia, basically without even a backing from the authority at the start, but later on with backing from authorities on both sides. And even with the Jordanians, we had contacts for many years, or decades in a way, that provided, created the kind of trust and understanding that led to it. We tried to do the same with the Syrians and with the Palestinians later on when I tried with Clinton. Whenever you cannot succeed in having basically most of it concluded far from the public eye, in a back channels, the chances of success are much lower when it being pushed directly to the in the face of the other one. I'm very pessimistic in the short term about the Arab world, but very optimistic in the or slightly more optimistic in the longer term, because they are not living in a different planet. They have a lot of inertia for their orthodoxies and traditions, but people, especially young people, they see what happens around them and what are the opportunities they're given to human beings in places who chose a different way. And when you look carefully at what happened in Jordan in the last several years under King Abdullah, basically moving in the footsteps of his late father, and even in Qatar, in Kuwait, in the Gulf State, the Emirates, I believe that the first signs could be seen even in Saudi Arabia. I become slightly more optimistic. And I believe that as a part of the success that you had now, however partial, in Iraq, probably what happened in Lebanon could signal what will happen to Bashar al-Assad, ultimately. Once he cannot argue that he is fighting the Zionist entities by proxy through Lebanon, if he was enforced, compelled to leave Lebanon, it is the beginning of countdown toward the end of the Assad regime in Syria.
True.
So,
do you think Iran considers Israel a mortal enemy, or that's words?
No, I think that it's very serious on behalf of these clerics and extremists. And even moderates like Rafsanjani is very dangerous in his attitude to Israel. But I can never forget it. I was already a young captain when Iran was our best friend in the Middle East. Friend, strategic ally. And it was the same people. And I know the people. I was a graduate student at the School of Engineering at Stanford with a group of brilliant Iranian engineers that remained friends of mine. I don't want even to mention their names, but basically it's a very capable
people. Can you communicate with them today?
No. Very capable. I can, but I don't want to for obvious reasons. A very capable people. Unlike the Arab world, where the leadership is pro-American, but the peoples still hate America. In Iran, it's the opposite way. The leadership is extremely anti-American, but the people love America. And when I remember just a generation ago, they were our best friends. I remember the generals hanged out of the refrigerators of the hospitals with their bodies. And they were friends of us. And after a generation, a whole generation, the ultra-fundamentalist Muslim leadership is detested, despised by their own people. So something very important simmering underneath the surface. I don't believe that in 5 years from now the revolution will still be in power there. And the question is, of course, what will happen with the nuclear military program if they will become nuclear before moderates will take over?
Yeah.
Even the moderates will not give it up. If moderates will take over long before they become nuclear, probably there is a good chance of blocking them.
Israel's worried about that new organization?
Of course we are worried, but we think that at the same time, it's a major threat to Israel, but it's a major to any possible world order.
Right.
Within a few years, they might have missiles that can reach Eastern Europe, and a few years later, Western Europe. It doesn't make sense. And nuclear Iran is a threat to the whole world. And I believe the right way is to probably carry the big stick hovering in the air, but on the ground, it's better to deploy kind of effective sanction operation.
Diplomacy.
The kind of which convinced ultimately Gaddafi to give up his nuclear place. And that kind of circle or political siege should include Russia and China, without which it can't work. And that's coming in contradiction to to the basic American policy.
But basically, negotiation is not simple. And that's probably bring us to the real role of Cheney in Camp David 1. Think of two leaders who are negotiating. Once they start to negotiate, especially with the present level of penetration of media into any kind of, beyond any closed doors, it ends up that quite early, the publics on both sides start to learn about what kind of issues are discussed, what kind of concessions are contemplated by their leaders. So the leaders tend to lose their power base, their support from within their own publics long before they have an agreement and long before they know whether they will have an agreement at all. So for leaders who basically have a kind of survival instinct, it's kind of a lose-lose. You start something, you don't know whether you will get something, but you are assured about the damage. So there is no easy way to pass it, bypass it. And the right answer is to find a formula under which negotiations are won on two levels simultaneously. One level which is public, which goes slow, and looks more like a minuet that people are dancing against each other, or like porcupine making love, you know how they make love? Cautiously. So they should be very cautious on the public level, where the whole public follows. But there should be a back channel where issues could be discussed in much more direct and concrete manner. And far from the public eye, with certain reliability of this arrangement, namely that the leaders on both sides can trust the fact that it's not going to be exposed. This trust might allow them or incentivize them to put real positions on the table. It's only when within this back channel, far from the public eye, something is ripe enough to be pushed to the surface, then it is pushed to the surface and a dramatic conclusion can take place. This happened in any successful negotiation between us and and our neighbors. In fact, it started long before Camp David won. Even when Rabin was prime minister, there were already contacts after the war, but Rabin was prime minister, 75, 76. Sadat sent to Hami to meet with the head of Mossad, then head of Mossad, Yitzhak Kofi Haka, in Morocco, in Ifran, the same place that he later met Dayan. But they met when Rabin was still prime minister. They put basically the same ideas or proposal. Haka brought it here, but it was already on the way to election. The government was not stable, so there was not enough time to look more closely into it. So when Menachem Begin was elected, he immediately knew, he was reported by both Rabin and Haka about the fact that there were contacts with the Egyptians, that Tuhami was quite a colorful character, but was sent by Sadat. Andrea Zulai was involved in the court of the king, King Hassan at the time. And King Hassan was aware of it and verified that it's really representative of Sadat. And basically, Begin, I believe, immediately identified the great opportunity here, together with risk, but great opportunity, and that probably why he insisted so much on bringing into government Moshe Dayan, whom he believed will be a one that can back professionally, so to speak, major kind of concessions if they are needed to be done, and also with Ezer Weitzman, which was very comfortable as a partner. So I think that when Sadat, as I described earlier, contemplated the tour to the Knesset, it was after he met under Begin government with Dayan. And Dayan swore to the last day of his life that he never told to Ami explicitly that he's going to get Sinai for peace. But somehow Tuami came back and could convince Sadat that this government is serious about it and that he can't dare to move. So something had to be exchanged that convinced Tuami and convinced Sadat. So when he came, he basically knew that it's ripe. It still need a lot of dare, and he paid with his life. You know, we have on the Arab side, Sadat paid with his life for daring to make peace, and on our side, Rabin. So he was clearly aware of the risks. But that's one of the tests of great leadership. He was ready to do it, and that's how it starts. And we should remember that even a year after his visit to the Knesset, that broke basically the psychological hurdles toward normalization with Egypt. Even a year later, when Begin went to Camp David first, still the feeling among the Israeli public was quite negative. Two-thirds, if you would have run a poll, and there were polls there, were against any agreement. It took the shaping formative power of leadership and the results, and also the fact that I think should be kept later on, and we couldn't keep it for some reason. The capacity to close a place, what was unique to Camp David is that they closed themselves in this isolated site for 2 weeks without letting anyone to know what exactly going on. That was critical, crucial for the achievement, because I can judge our side. If the public in Israel would have known what we know now about the ups and downs and the disputes and the position of Sadat, position of Begin, what Carter tried to do, how Azer and Dayan helped it, and Samuel Baden. If we would have known the whole story in real time, probably he could not continue it without losing too much. The fact that it was done this way was a crucial element in the success.
I know you got to go. Ayod, if I ask you who your hero is in life, do you have one?
Oh, not a single one, but a group, a whole group of them.
You're a groupie.
Yeah, no, I'm not a groupie. I think of...
I asked Shamir this question. Yeah. You know, I thought he would say Jabotinsky. You know what he said to me?
King Saul.
Mao Tse-tung. You know why? Because he fed 1 billion people. Fascinating answer.
Yeah. I don't have one of them, but I followed many historical figures admiring way in retrospect, at least.
Thanks for coming. Always good to see you. Ehud Balarak, the man who's running again to be the acting chairman of the Labor Party, and as thus would lead the Labor Party if they win election to becoming prime minister again. The one who did that, my recollection, was Yitzhak Rabin, who lost in 75 and then came back, and he took it over again and became very, very popular. We'll see you next week.
Read to a child today and spark a lifetime of ambition.
Know what?
What?
Since I got adopted, I've learned a lot about these humans.
I know. I mean, check out these two. It's Flirt City over here.
Yeah, I noticed that. It looks like my human is definitely into your human.
Oh, look! I think she's getting his number.
Nice.
Your human's got some sweet moves.
Takes after his dog. Oh, look, they're doing that thing where they put their arms around each other.
She kicked up a leg. It's like in the movies.
That's awesome. Looks like we're going to be hanging out a little bit more.
The average text takes your eyes off the road for nearly 5 seconds.
Wow, these are really good.
You act surprised. Practice makes perfect.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you.
Traditional light bulbs actually generate 9 times more heat than light. Switch to Energy Star light bulbs, and you'll realize just how much cash you are really burning through. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Nice.
No!
Come on!
Oh. Oops.
Yeah, sure.
Stung.
Moms everywhere are finding ways to keep kids active and healthy.
Works every time.
Get ideas, get involved, get going at letsmove.gov.
So, I got this new family. And I don't know what it is about this one, but she can't seem to put down that toy all day long. Tap, 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 tap. Oh, and she even talks to it. She talks to that more than she talks to him. What's up, bro? Nice shirt. Who's she talking to? Her mom? She talks to her mom a lot.